content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we will pick up where we left off on our last program with an article titled, It Can't Happen Here, by Adam Hochschild. An ambitious New Deal program brought fascism into the spotlight. Then the drama moved onto the political stage. In our last program, we read about Sinclair Lewis, who wrote a new novel titled, It Can't Happen Here, which portrayed an unscrupulous, power-hungry senator named Berzelius Buzz Windrip, aided by a Coughlin-like Bishop Prang, wins the 1936 presidential election. This was in reaction to the rise of the Nazis in Europe after his wife, Dorothy Thompson, was basically expelled from Nazi Germany. And we also learned about the Federal Theater Project, which was led by Hallie Flanagan. It was part of the Works Progress Administration, where they said that essentially unemployed actors get just as hungry as anybody else. At its peak, the Federal Theater Project employed nearly 13,000, so it put the lights back on in dozens of theaters, and its productions traveled to prisons, reformatories, settlement houses, and psychiatric hospitals. In summer, the project mounted free plays in parks. When 1 million people in the Ohio River Valley fled a disastrous flood, a Federal Theater Project vaudeville troupe performed for weeks in the camps, shuttered factories, and garages where the refugees were housed. So altogether, the project's more than 1,200 plays would be seen by nearly 30 million people, up to 65% of whom had never seen live theater before. Hanny Flanagan and her staff thought It Can't Happen Here, the play by Sinclair Lewis, would make a splendid, timely play. Sinclair Lewis was not known for being a playwright, however, so Flanagan paired him with the Hollywood scriptwriter John C. Moffat. Their collaboration turned out to be tempestuous, and the two were soon not on speaking terms. Flanagan installed them in apartments on different floors of New York's Essex House on Central Park South, where they wrote and raged at each other, while she mediated by passing notes between them. Mr. Moffat paced up and down in his apartment and threatened, if Mr. Lewis did not omit certain scenes and include others, various unusual reprisals, she later recalled in her memoir. Before long, Moffat fled back to Hollywood, and Flanagan replaced him with another writer. And here's where we'll pick up where we left off. Flanagan was eager to show that drama was not just for Broadway audiences, but for everyone, in what one scholar calls probably the largest mass opening in the history of the theater. It Can't Happen Here was scheduled to premiere simultaneously on 21 stages in 17 states. As opening night approached, frantic telegrams flowed in from theaters. Denver, where's revised version Act 3, Lewis play Rush immediately. Chicago, new ending revised Act 3 Lewis play does not make sense. Please advise. San Francisco, object to cutting White House scene, only good scene Lewis play. Nebraska, person in high place considers White House scene, quote, ill-advised, unquote. Letter follows. Los Angeles, imperative have no more revision. Flanagan and her colleagues had their own last-minute jitters about offending people who could threaten their funding. 5 days before opening night, they telegraphed all 21 theaters. Cut White House scene, stop. Cut line, quote, Billy Goats of Supreme Court, unquote, stop. Other obstacles loomed. In New Orleans, there was some concern that audiences would see the play as a dig against the recently assassinated governor and U.S. Senator Huey P. Long. Although Long was on the political left, he battled corporations, promoted federal spending, and advocated for the redistribution of wealth. He also pushed through laws that stripped power from courts, cities, and counties, and concentrated it in state government he tightly controlled. He built a new and ostentatious governor's mansion in state capital, and had state police cars delivering copies of a newspaper he ran. When a legislator suggested he was violating the Louisiana Constitution, he replied, "I'm the Constitution around here now." He had set his sights set on the presidency when the son-in-law of a political rival killed him in 1935. New Orleans officials, Flanagan later wrote in her memoir, felt it inadvisable to produce a play against dictatorship in a city where many people still revered the memory of Huey Long. There were no performances in Louisiana. Lewis continued to revise and argue with his latest collaborator, meddling ceaselessly with the casting and rehearsals of the flagship production on Broadway. 2 days before opening night, he called Flanagan at 7 a.m. to thunder that it was no good. "I want you to postpone the play a week and get new people to do everything, or do it yourself. Why, the living room they have got up there on the stage looks more like a cheap boarding house. It is all terrible. It is all a failure." Flanagan altered the set to mollify him. The play opened in all 21 theaters on schedule on October 27, 1936. In Broadway's Adelphi Theater, every seat was taken, and 100 spectators stood in the rear. A photo shows Flanagan chatting with the gangly Lewis, towering a head and a half above her, before they took their seats. "As the house lights dimmed and the audience rustled into silence," she recalled, "I watched anxiously. At the intermission, she hailed a taxi and rushed downtown to catch part of the play at another theater, in Yiddish. Despite not knowing the language, she found the actors far more expressive, and on the whole, I thought it a better show. Unlike the English production, the Yiddish language version also included a scene in a concentration camp." Flanagan headed back to Broadway in time to hear a vigorous ovation. "The tall, gaunt, awkward Lewis," wrote one spectator, "who looked like a dolled-up scarecrow in his tuxedo, finally emerged on the stage. When the audience demanded, 'Speech, speech,' Lewis replied that the play itself was his speech. He and Dorothy Thompson then hosted a party at the Plaza Hotel for the cast and crew. Telegrams flowed in and from around the country, telling of enthusiastic capacity audiences. In Boston, 300 people had been turned away. The play was unusual not only for its nationwide opening. Actors in Chicago spilled into the theater's aisles and boxes to bring the action closer to the audience. The production in Tampa, in Spanish. In Seattle, the cast was all black, except for the would-be dictator and his sidekicks, who were white. And this at a time when white and black actors virtually never appeared on the same stage. Like New York, Los Angeles held performances in both English and Yiddish. For some of the actors in the Yiddish versions, the sight of uninformed, jackbooted militiamen strutting about the stage was frighteningly familiar, because they were refugees from Europe. On the opening night of the New York Yiddish production, several audience members fainted. The play was no masterpiece, an ungainly sprawl with a cast of more than two dozen that, if not shortened by a director, ran 3.5 hours. But its action spoke to the political movement. The theater enlarged its appeal beyond mere entertainment into a living, graphic document of contemporary forces, wrote the Miami Herald. The New York Times critic Brooks Atkinson thought the play crude, but acknowledged that thousands of Americans who do not know what a fascist dictatorship would mean now have an opportunity to find out. After the initial run, a New York suitcase traveling company, with its sets all folded into a 30-foot-long truck compartment, brought 133 performances of the play to school auditoriums, civilian conservation corps camps, and other venues. Federal theater project units in several other states, as well as New York's Yiddish production, also took the play on the road. Altogether, at an average ticket price of 30 cents, as many as 379,000 people saw the show. Only a few months before It Can't Happen Here unfolded on American stages, far-right army officers in Spain revolted against the country's democratically elected government. Hitler and Mussolini rushed bomber squadrons, tanks, artillery, and other help to the rebel officers. The Spanish government appealed to the Western democracies to sell it arms, but in vain. Foreign volunteers, who before long would include 2,800 Americans, rushed to defend Spanish democracy. Suddenly, the long simmering advance of fascism was boiling over into war. While millions of Americans worried about an increasingly bellicose Hitler, others feared that the Great Depression would push the U.S. electorate into the direction of socialism. That seemed to be happening in some places abroad. In France, the left-leaning Popular Front won power in 1936, and socialist Léon Blum became prime minister. American business groups began pumping out a torrent of books, articles, and pamphlets attacking the New Deal. One of the most strident of these groups was called the Constitutional Educational League. The organization attacked Roosevelt, Jews, and labor unions in a blizzard of newsletters and pamphlets with titles like Communism in Our Schools, Don't Say We Didn't Warn You, and High Taxes, the Quick Way to Communism. The great majority of the Federal Theater Project's plays were in the standard repertory, from Shakespeare to Gilbert and Sullivan, but some reflected the values of the New Deal. One Third of a Nation, for example, took its title from Roosevelt's second inaugural address and dramatized the plight of people in shoddy and dangerous housing. Dialogue of senators objecting to subsidized housing was taken straight from the congressional record. When a slum tenement in Philadelphia collapsed, the event was written into that city's version of the show. Another Federal Theater Project play, Triple A Plowed Under, showed how farmers succumbed to debt and saw their land auctioned off. A very young Orson Welles directed an all-black cast in Macbeth, set in Haiti, with the witches as voodoo priestesses that toured the country in a special train and was seen by 150,000 people. A play called Spirochet tackled a subject seldom dealt with on American stage, syphilis. In the lobby of the Chicago Theater where it played, nurses and doctors offered the audience blood tests. The plays continued to win critical praise. Eleanor Roosevelt attended performances. Two of the greatest living playwrights, George Bernard Shaw and Eugene O'Neill, gave the project the right to perform some 24 of their plays at royalties far below the normal rate, so long as ticket prices were kept low. The average theater ticket during the Great Depression was around $1.10 to $2.20. The Federal Theater Project was able to make its tickets comparable to the 25-cent admission price for a movie. Countries as varied as Norway, Mexico, and Czechoslovakia sent representatives to study the project. Versions of It Can't Happen Here reached the stage in Canada and in France. Flanagan was invited to speak about her work in Europe. With support from the White House and from theatergoers around the country, she was riding high. She received such an overwhelming cascade of mail that the project was given an additional staff member to help sort through it, a quiet young woman named Hazel Huffman. At first, no one paid her much attention. Although programs like the Federal Theater Project were highly popular with the public, there were danger signs for its longevity. In early 1938, a U.S. senator from Georgia denounced Turpentine, a Federal Theater Project play with a black cast about the South's notorious debt bondage labor camps. Many white politicians from the Jim Crow South were also upset with Flanagan's insistence on integrating audiences and equal pay for black and white actors. When the committee that would later be known as the House Committee on Un-American Activities formed in the spring of 1938, with a focus on stopping communist infiltration, one of the first groups it investigated was the Federal Theater Project. The hearing itself was high drama, complete with a surprise player, Hazel Huffman, a former mailroom worker for the project who turned out to be an undercover agent. Huffman claimed to represent an organization of 900 theatrical employees, but little trace of such a body existed other than a letterhead listing her as its secretary. Flanagan said she found a proof indicating that Huffman was paid for leaking draft scripts of the project's plays and other confidential information to the extremely hostile Hearst newspaper chain. One Hearst paper fired a drama critic who favorably reviewed one of the plays. Other evidence suggests that Huffman's backer may have been the Constitutional Education League, which gave its annual Americanism Award for that year to Congressman Martin Dees of Texas, the House's committee chair. The League and Dees' committee shared files on those they considered subversive. In the witness chair, Huffman unleashed accusations against Flanagan and her colleagues, incompetence, wasteful spending, and more. But her main focus was communism. She proclaimed that communist leaflets were sometimes distributed in the project's offices, that Flanagan had written of her admiration for the experimental Soviet theater of the 1920s, that some federal theater project staff were members of the Communist Party or its front groups, and that black protest songs used in a play, How Long, Brethren, had been previously published in Communist Magazine. All of this was true and not surprising, for in the 1930s, the American Communist Party was at its height of its influence, and WPA officials were not allowed to ask about the political affiliations of their employees. Huffman condemned It Can't Happen Here as anti-fascist in the extreme. With Huffman's help, the committee found several others present or former employees of the project to testify. One spoke darkly of the numerous aliens the program employed. Another, a former stage manager, testified about a staff party where men of the colored race were dancing with white women. Sally Saunders, an actress and Austrian immigrant, testified about how shocked she was to be asked for a date by a black man working on the project, charging that social equity and race merging was part of the communist program. Reds urged mixed date, Blonde tells D's probers, trumpeted William Randolph Hearst, New York Journal American, beside a large photo of Saunders with a dark hat tilted atop her blonde pin curls. The committee made little attempt to balance the testimonies of Huffman and other adversaries with those of witnesses defending the project. Only months later was Flanagan even allowed to appear. Committee members grilled her using a list of questions prepared by Huffman. Alabama Congressman Joe Starnes repeatedly interrupted Flanagan to ask her about communistic tendencies. "You are quoting from this Christopher Marlowe," he said at one point. "Is he a communist?" "He was a great dramatist, immediately preceding Shakespeare," Flanagan explained. Starnes also inquired about the seditious inclinations of Mr. Euripides. After a few more such exchanges, the committee cut off Flanagan's testimony, and she never got the chance to read a statement she had prepared. Admirers in the press defended her, with columnist Haywood Braun facetiously praising the acumen of stars, who can detect a radical at a distance of more than three centuries. The hearings marked the beginning of the end for the Federal Theater Project. Both House and Senate debated a measure to save it, but despite passionate lobbying by famous directors and actors, one of them, Tallulah Bankhead, was the niece of a senator and the daughter of the Speaker of the House. It was given only a few more months of life. On the final night of the project's production of the children's play Pinocchio at New York's Ritz Theater, the curtains remained open as stagehands dismantled the set and laid the puppet in a coffin labeled "Killed by Act of Congress, June 30th, 1939. What remained of the project, Flanagan wrote, was a blueprint, a memorandum for tomorrow. The fascist takeover portrayed in It Can't Happen Here never did happen here, but of course it did happen elsewhere, as Hitler's troops moved first into Austria, then Czechoslovakia's Sudetenland, and finally into almost all of Europe. Japan spread a similar sort of rule throughout Asia, and before long, the United States was at war. The people whose lives intersected through the Federal Theater Project went their different ways. Flanagan returned to her job as a college professor. Dorothy Thompson's marriage to Sinclair Lewis did not last, but her career as a journalist did. The three times a week syndicated political column she wrote, a first for an American woman, was read by millions. Conspicuously laughing and jeering from a press seat, she attended the notorious 1939 rally, where 20,000 supporters of the German-American Bund filled Madison Square Garden. She went on to cover World War II, and she was so respected for her prescient denunciation of fascism that she was invited to address Britain's House of Commons. She also sponsored numerous Jewish refugees immigrating to the United States, which earned her a flood of anti-Semitic hate mail. As for Huffman, she went on to do more work for the House Committee. After attending a rally where Woody Guthrie sang, she testified about the folk singer's subversive tendencies. Her papers reveal an anxious woman, constantly prospecting for more undercover assignments and struggling with successive drafts of the never-published book about the Red Theater. Actors continued to perform It Can't Happen Here after its Federal Theater Project run. In one Massachusetts summer stock production, Sinclair Lewis himself appeared on stage, playing the role of the heroic journalist who helps defeat the fascist militia. This allows him to claim such lines as, "This isn't any one-horse European country that a dictator could get hold of. No, sir, it can't happen here." MGM bought the screen rights for It Can't Happen Here from Lewis, lining up an all-star cast including James Stewart and Lionel Barrymore. However, after reportedly spending $200,000, roughly $4 million today, on casting, sets, and other expenses, the studio canceled the project. MGM gave various excuses, but most evidence suggests that it feared that going ahead with the film would cut off the lucrative market for all movies in fascist Italy, Nazi Germany, and Japan. Indeed, the German Film Chamber in Berlin denounced Lewis as a full-blooded communist. MGM soon found a less threatening product in 1939 with Gone with the Wind. Hitler so loved it that he reportedly watched the film three times. Now we'll pop over to The Past is Prologue and read an article under the title The Height of Modernity by Michael Snyder. Towering ambitions built the most charming skyscraper in America. Talking about an American icon. On a mild day in October in 1929, the architect William Van Alen watched from the corner of 42nd Street and 5th Avenue in Manhattan as a 185-foot steel needle rose from the guts of his unfinished masterpiece, the Chrysler Building. For months, New York media had breathlessly covered the battle between Van Alen and his former business partner, H. Craig Severance, to complete the city's tallest building. Van Alen's 27-ton spire, secretly assembled high up in the building's skeleton, was his trump card. Hoisted into place in less than 2 hours, the spire brought the Chrysler's height to 1,046 feet, hardly beating Severance's Manhattan Company building. But there was scarcely time for celebration. Plans had already been announced for the Empire State Building, which would shatter the Chrysler's record just over a year later. More importantly, the morning after Van Alen's coup, a calamitous stock market crash plunged the United States into the deepest economic crisis the country had known. With its electro-steel helmet and grandiose lobby, a temple to the power of American industry, the Chrysler Building encapsulated the giddy excess of its time, an Art Deco exclamation point to mark the end of an optimistic decade. Dominating the New York skyline brought prestige and publicity, but tall towers also resolved a more prosaic problem. As land prices climbed, developers had to build upward to turn a profit, pushing their projects as high as engineering, natural light, and eventually zoning would allow. skyscrapers were a self-fulfilling prophecy of the heated real estate market, writes Neil Bascom in his 2003 book, Higher, A Historic Race to the Sky and Making of a City. By the 1920s, with Europe in ashes after World War I, these buildings became brash totems of New World Order. Manhattan, in particular, had become the harbor of the world, messenger of the new land, of the gold diggers, and of world conquest, wrote the German architect Erich Mendelssohn in his seminal 1926 book, America, published the year after New York overtook London as the world's most populous city. As the New York Times reported in May 1929, skyscrapers had become to the whole of the United States a symbol, a fashion, and a heaven-climbing contest. Money seemed inexhaustible, and as speculation came to defy the laws of financial logic, buildings increasingly seemed to defy the laws of physics. When the market plunged, vacancies in New York soared. The Empire State Building, for instance, sat mostly empty for almost a decade. The Chrysler fared better, opening in 1930 with over 70% occupancy by companies, including Western Union, and of course Chrysler, whose founder, Walter Chrysler, had purchased the lease on the lot, Van Alen's design, before construction began. Even still, what one writer for Scientific American had in 1930, called a towering sword of fire, soon looked like a gaudy act of hubris. In a brutal 1931 takedown for the New Republic, the legendary critic Lewis Mumford dismissed the building as a series of restless mistakes. Moreover, he wrote that the Chrysler proved the real dangers of plutocracy, gives the masters of our civilization an unusual opportunity to exhibit their barbarous egos. But ego alone was not enough to make projects at this scale work. After the Chrysler family sold the tower in 1953, the building went into four decades of decline as successive owners cut maintenance costs, drilled lights into the lobby's painted ceiling, and used the spire to store junk. In the early 1970s, with New York itself careening toward bankruptcy, the Chrysler's occupancy rate reached a catastrophic low of 17%. And even after its 1978 inscription by the city's Landmarks Preservation Commission, the building kept slipping further into disrepair. A $100 million renovation in the late 1990s resuscitated the building, but it continued to change hands, most recently in 2019 as more desirable towers sprout up around it. Surrounded by giants, the Chrysler Building today seems almost diminutive, yet perhaps no other New York building attracts such admiration. The skyscraper is a romantic concept, and the Chrysler speaks to the romantic possibilities of the still young nation. As Madeline Ruthven wrote in a 1937 poem named for Van Alen's crowning achievement, "These airy mountains of glass are the signature of an age, a way of life that must pass." And this article was cut for time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.